Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, July 20th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Steve. It's good to be here.
And also with us is WCAI's reporter Sarah Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Andy Tomolonis at southcoasttoday.com. Now we'll look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. Kristen, let's start off talking about a story that you covered for the Cape Cod Times, and our reporter Sarah Tan also covered it. The offshore wind company Vineyard Wind is proposing to bring its power transmission cable ashore through Lewis Bay. Some Yarmouth residents spoke out on this at a meeting this week. Sarah, let me start with you. Tell us about this meeting and what were residents saying?
Sure. So it was a forum held by the Selectmen and Vineyard Wind to hear residents' concerns around Vineyard Wind's plans to bring their offshore wind cable through Lewis Bay. There have been kind of rumblings over the past few weeks of environmental concerns from people like the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. But this meeting was kind of the first formalized effort to hear concerns from residents. And it was also the first, I would say, it was the first opportunity for a small group of residents that have kind of started to formalize around their opposition to the cable to come forward and voice their concerns.
Kristen, Vineyard Wind already had a host agreement with Yarmouth for bringing this power cable ashore, but they've withdrawn it?
Well, they proposed, they requested a host community agreement request from the Board of Selectmen in January. But I think when they initially made that request, they took a second look when they were starting to hear some feedback and said, hold on, let's put the brakes on this and let's take a few minutes to really do some more research, gather some more public feedback, and we're going to come back again later on and then file a new host community agreement request. What that request would do is stipulate what compensation or protections the town of Yarmouth could receive. Just to give you a reference, a draft of the earlier agreement, which again was withdrawn, included annual payments to Yarmouth of $450,000 for a 25-year period. It also included a one-time $1 million payment for infrastructure improvements. And what Vineyard Wind and Yarmouth officials have said they're considering as possibly part of a new agreement that could be struck would be additional funds to cover the cost of any reseeding any shellfish beds that might be disturbed during installation of the cable, which is planned to be buried about 7 to 8 feet underneath the seafloor.
Well, let me ask you, Sarah, what were some of the concerns that that citizens were bringing forward at the meeting?
I mean, most of them did say that they were not against offshore wind in general, but they're just concerned because the cable, they say, is going to disrupt an already fragile ecosystem underneath Lewis Bay. They say it's going to go through mooring grounds and also shellfishing grounds. They say there's really nothing that they could be paid that would make that okay. They say once it's destroyed, it's destroyed.
And alternative sites?
Sure. So the Vineyard Wind has identified a second site, which is, you know, not their preferred site, but an alternative site at William H. Covell Memorial Beach in Centerville. Now, Yarmouth residents are really urging Vineyard Wind to go back and look at that site. They say that going to Covell Beach would not require going through Lewis Bay, so it would avoid sort of that ecologically fragile area, and that would offer a more direct route through Nantucket Sound. But Vineyard Wind has also said that once you come onshore, there are some complications that could make it more expensive. They'd have to go through a densely populated residential neighborhood and other commercial areas, and that they've also discovered, or their research team has discovered, eelgrass, which provides a habitat for some species of endangered fish in the water near the beach. And also the people who use the beach, it's a very popular beach in the summer, that people may not be so thrilled with the idea of that cable coming on shore there.
What happens next? What's the decision process for like for this?
Well, so the site that they have, you know, they've selected as New Hampshire Avenue in Yarmouth as their preferred landing site. And really, the final decision makers will be the MA Energy Facilities Siting Board and the Massachusetts Environmental Protection Act. And those entities will rely on input from different agencies to determine which route is the most feasible and also ensures the lowest environmental impacts. So it will really be sort of a state and federal decision.
Let's move on. I want to talk about the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. It's requesting an exemption from having a safety zone around the site after it shuts down next year. Kristen, tell us what's going on here.
That's right. So Entergy, which owns the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant, has requested an elimination of a 10-mile emergency planning zone around the reactor about 10 months after the reactor is scheduled to power down for the final time, which will be in June of 2019. The company basically is saying that the requirements are expensive and unnecessary, that right now there are actually a few towns that fall within that 10-mile radius: Plymouth, Kingston, Marshfield, Duxbury, and Carver. And Entergy is saying that they've performed an analysis that shows that by the time 10 months passes after the shutdown, the radioactive fuel rods in the spent fuel pool will have cooled enough so that the risk of a fire would really be minimal. They said it would take 10 hours for the hottest fuel rods in that pool to reach 900 degrees Celsius, which is the point where they would start a fire. They say that 10 hours would give nearby communities enough time to react.
Advocates are obviously speaking out against this, saying that this is not a good idea to relax these regulations.
That's right. One activist from Duxbury, Mary Lampert, said that the risk really doesn't disappear. She said that that Entergy is really just looking more at saving money than they are at looking at health and safety risks. Another one of our activists here on Cape, Diane Turco, who's the president of the Cape Downwinders, sort of agreed with that sentiment. She said that the denial of spent fuel dangers by Entergy could have tragic consequences. One of the things that I found interesting, though, is that to date, I guess, every nuclear power plant in the U.S. that has decommissioned has requested an exemption, and they've all, in every case, the federal authorities have granted it.
I was shocked when I read that, but I guess that indicates what the feeling of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is on this. So, and they are still formalizing rules around decommissioning of plants. I'm sure we're going to be hearing more about this going forward. One more story here to talk about. We've been following this for some weeks now. In Falmouth, there's been a proposal to site a new drug rehab facility next to a public school, and that story took a new turn this week.
That's right. So Gosnold has decided to expand its search for a location for that facility. Previously, they'd been focusing on a former nursing home at 359 Jones Road, which is right next to the Morse Pond Elementary School. Right next to a school there. And I guess on Monday, Gosnold issued a release saying that the leadership team was expanding a search for a new location. They said they heard the communications from the community loud and clear, and that they're going to be taking a look a little more broadly at where they could move that facility. The plan currently calls for moving Gosnold's current 35-bed treatment facility, which is on Terhune Drive, to expand it to include 99 beds, including 30 for patients who also have mental health disorders in addition to problems with addiction. That plan will probably stay in place, but really the change here is that they're looking for a different site.
This has obviously been a big story. I think we've talked about it the last three news roundups as the community opposition to the site has gotten louder and louder. Sounds like Gosnold is trying to respond to that. They don't have a site in mind, a secondary site, is that right? And they also had a special meeting set up for next week to try to deal with some of the community concerns. Now it looks like maybe that meeting isn't going to have to happen either.
Correct. They had scheduled with the school committee a special meeting on July 25th to give the public a chance to listen to Gosnold and to hear some from security experts about sort of what the plan would be there. And a member of the Zoning Board of Appeals was also going to be there to explain the review process, but it is unclear whether or not that meeting will actually happen.
We're going to speak now with Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, you've got an update on the possibility of a gaming hall opening on the Vineyard. This would be with the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead Aquinnah. We heard a lot about this over the winter when some of the legal decisions were made. Where do things stand now?
Yeah, over the winter, the last, after all these back and forth legal decisions, the last decision came down that really cleared the way for the tribe to pursue Class 2 gaming here on the island, which is electronic bingo machines. And when that decision came through back in January, the word was from tribal leaders that a gaming facility could be up and running this summer. So far, that is not the case. There's not a lot of information about what the plans are, what a timeline might look like. This week, the tribal chairman, Cheryl Andrews-Maltese, declined to offer much further comment. She said that they're still working on the initiative, and they will provide further information when they have it and when it's appropriate. So it's not clear things like whether a site has been planned. It will be on, the, as of now, tribe-owned land somewhere in Aquinna. Tribe leaders have said they will not use a recently completed community center in town, but otherwise it's not clear where it will be. And, you know, on the vineyard, there's always a lot of attention to any new developments, and this is especially, you know, a pretty different kind of facility, and it's in Aquinna, which is one of the smallest, I think the second smallest town in the state, and it's pretty rural. So this would be a significant development there. You know, a member of the Aquinna Board of Selectmen said, you know, that the tribal leaders haven't approached him or the town with plans or sought any permits, so he... You know, he pointed out they would need to work out things like that, like things like emergency services, who would be providing that, who would be paying for that. And, you know, there's also some debate still about how financially viable a gaming facility would be here on the vineyard. And a study, I think in 2015 by the tribe, suggested that they thought they could make profits of about $4.5 million to $5 million over the first 3 years. But it's not clear, you know, what information that was based on. And our reporter, Steve Myrick, talked to a few gaming experts this week to, you know, to get their opinion after watching the industry. And one professor said he thinks the facility here would require a relatively small investment. It's a smaller operation, a Class 2 facility with no slot machines, electronic bingo machines. He said that wouldn't be a problem. But others are skeptical. And Donald Wittes, who's a former tribal chairman, he's an opponent of this idea. He said he thinks it doesn't make economic sense, especially with, you know, how do you get people here, enough people here through the ferry and on the roads and through the airport that would support having enough people to make it viable. And there's also been some talk about whether this might be leverage for the tribe to establish a casino on the mainland. But but it's kind of a, right now I think it's a watch and wait. So right now there's just a lot of, like I said, not a lot of information. I think a lot of people wondering what this might look like.
Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, I want to let listeners know that this is your last news roundup as you're leaving the Gazette for new adventures. I want to thank you personally for being part of the roundup for so long. It's been a pleasure each week to speak with you.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure for me, too, and I'll enjoy listening to the roundup going forward as I head off on my next chapter.
Okay, best of luck to you.
Great. Thank you. Bye.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. And on the phone with us right now from the Cape Cod Chronicle is Tim Wood. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, the town of Harwich is getting some money from the state to develop cultural districts. Tell us about this and what it means.
Sure. This is all part of a drive that has been going on in Harwich now for a number of months to try to make Harwich a cultural center for the region. And as part of that, not only to bring arts to the town and the Lower Cape area here, but to also help boost the local economy. Now, a few months ago, Harwich became the first town in the state to join the Massachusetts Cultural Council's Cultural Compact pilot program, which is designed to help the town a town promote its arts activities. And now, just last week, the state cultural council awarded the town a $10,000 grant to help establish two cultural districts in town. Now, the grant will cover the costs of printing of a cultural district map, signs, and design of a website to promote it, as well as some upgrades to the auditorium and cafeteria of the Harwich Cultural Center, which is the former Harwich Middle School, which, if you recall, has become a real mecca for artists and art lovers in this area. Mm-hmm. In the last year, they've basically rented out every former classroom in that building to local artists to use as studios. It's open to the public. People can wander in and talk to the artists. This summer, they're doing a musical series in the courtyard of that building on Thursday nights. They're getting some really interesting acts in there. It's kind of a fun scene they're creating at the cultural center. And that cultural center is really going to be the center of one of the two cultural districts that they're looking at creating in Harwich, and that's the Harwich Center Cultural District. And that will also include the community center, Brooks Library, the Harwich Historical Society's Brooks Academy Museum, and also the old schoolhouse in that village, which is used by the Harwich Junior Theater for classes and rehearsals and auditions and things like that. They're also looking at creating a second cultural district in Harwich Port, which would basically cover Route 28 from the Make Art Gallery, which is in South Harwich, down through the center of Harwich Port and just past there. And that encompasses a large number of art galleries and cultural events, such as the downtown area where the Port Summer Night Music strolls are held every Wednesday night during the summer. And what this grant will do is allow them to really delve into how they can attract people to these cultural districts and develop ways to promote them. Now, the grant was put together by the Chamber of Commerce Director Cindy Williams and town planner Charlene Greenhalge, who will be the administrator for the grant. And over the next few weeks, they'll be meeting with stakeholders within the cultural districts that they're looking at to talk about how to approach this. And they also plan on making a public presentation at the non-resident taxpayer meeting with the Board of Selectmen, which is coming up on August 6th.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for updating us on that.
Thank you, Steve.
Kristen Young is with me from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, a report out says opioid prescription rates are declining on Cape Cod. Sounds like good news.
Yeah, that's right. The report was actually done by the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. It was a national report, and it stated that Massachusetts led the nation in reducing the number of opioid prescriptions written in the last few years, and that the state actually halved the number of prescriptions from 2013 to 2017. The Cape was right along there, too. I guess the state reduction was by about 51%, and the Cape's was by about 45%. You know, the part of the thoughts there are that there's been a lot of progress made in educating people and in educating physicians. Physicians are becoming less likely to prescribe large doses of opiates for things like a twisted ankle or tooth surgery, something like that. And instead, and also patients are deciding to opt out of receiving prescriptions for opioids and finding other ways to manage their pain. The study didn't include other insurances other than Blue Cross Blue Shield, but people are saying that it really does kind of reflect an overall decline in opioid prescription rates as a trend that's going on. Part of this may have been helped by the fact that Governor Charlie Baker signed a bill in March 2016, which gave the state the first law in the country limiting opioid prescriptions for first-time prescriptions to 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
So that may have been a part of the help there.
It was striking, I thought, that the Cape in 2012 had an opiate prescription rate about 24% higher than the state average. So it's really come a long way if we're falling below, if we're moving in the other direction.
Yes, that's right. In 2013, there were about 512 opioid prescriptions written per 1,000 Blue Cross Blue Shield members in the Barnstable-Yarmouth area. And by 2017, that number had dropped to 292 per 1,000.
And, of course, a lot of this has to do with trying to get people away from having the medications who might then fall into other pain, you know, opioid abuse situations, or having those medications out there in the community where they can be accessed by people who shouldn't be accessing them.
That's right. And also, I think part of this here is that there is sort of another edge to this. Although the opioid prescription numbers are going down, law enforcement is saying things like more deadly synthetic opioids that are sold illegally on the streets, such as fentanyl and carfentanil, are sort of on the rise. Fentanyl is about 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine, and carfentanil, which is an elephant tranquilizer, is about 10,000 times more potent than morphine. So that's something else to consider. Although, so what Blue Cross report is sort of saying is that people who haven't yet developed an addictive habit, that signs are good there for keeping that limited. But you know that these other more illegal substances are something to also be concerned about.
Mm-hmm. We're going to speak right now with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, new population estimates are in for the island. What's the story here?
The story is that no earth-shattering news. The population estimates from the Nantucket Data Platform, which is a nonprofit that was founded last year to crunch a bunch of numbers and come up with a continuously updated reservoir of data for town officials, nonprofits, and the first thing they tackled was the population. And they came up with a year-round population on Nantucket of 17,200 people. Now, that pretty much falls kind of in the middle or on the end, closer to what the town clerk has been estimating for years, of about 20,000 to 25,000 people out here year-round. And pretty far cry from the census numbers from 2010, which were 11,000. Mm-hmm. But pretty much anybody who lives on Nantucket knows that that's probably not the case. When there's 9,900 registered voters and over 1,000 kids in the school system, that just doesn't seem to make any sense. But the year-round population is only one small part of it. Nantucket, obviously, a very popular resort destination, summer vacation destination, and with a lot of transient residents. So what they also came up with was what they call the effective population, which were snapshots of the island's population at any given time of year. And what they were able to determine was that in addition to those 17,200 year-round residents, there are about 11,000 seasonal residents, about 6,600 seasonal workers, and about 365 people a day commute here just about year-round on the weekdays. They were even able to go so far using some data research tools to pinpoint the highest population time on the island, and that's the second week in August when the Boston Pops concert is here, when there's about 47,000 people, and the lowest point is the second week in March when a lot of people try and get out of here. It's a little gray and cold when it dips below 15,000. So they figure they're going to use all this information. The town can use it to better plan, make better decisions. It can also inform federal funding. The rule of thumb demographers say is that about $1,000 per person in federal and state funding comes in based on population numbers. So if they can bump that number up from the 11,000 years to somewhere around the 17,000 or even somewhere in between, that's a lot of money to the town between now and the next census.
Josh, some South Shore beaches were closed yesterday after a shark fin sighting.
They were. There was a shark fin sighting and a seal with some bite marks on it that were consistent with a shark attack washed up on South Shore, and lifeguards and the town harbor master decided that out of an abundance of caution, they would close the Surfside and Mayakamet beaches yesterday afternoon. They pulled a bunch of people out of the water. It was an unconfirmed shark fin sighting. Nobody actually saw the full shark, but they are saying that better safe than sorry. The South Shore of Nantucket, not usually the place where sharks are seen as much as frequently. It's more on the North Shore. Anybody who vacations in this area and lives in this area, Nantucket of the Cape, knows that there are a lot of sharks between the Cape and Nantucket Sound. But the South Shore, not so much. But yesterday there was, and they closed the beaches for a time, and it could very well happen again if the same thing happens.
Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
With me in the studio is Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, a group on the Lower Cape that provides help to people for things like housing and food has seen a big uptick in the amount of aid it's given out this year.
That's right. The Lower Cape Outreach Council has seen a 20% increase in emergency assistance spending in the first 5 months of this year over the first 5 months of last year. And that amounts to about $90,000 more in assistance that they've paid so far this year to Lower Cape residents that goes to things like shelter and provisions. From January to March, January to May, it also helped 76 more households this year than it did last year. And the largest spike has been seen in Harwich, followed by Orleans and Brewster in terms of the families where they live that are receiving the aid. Last year, the council spent about $431,000 over that time period, and this year it's already up to more than $522,000. And the CEO of that company says it's really the problem boils down to the fact that there's not enough affordable housing here for families.
The numbers that he cites here, he said that in the past they'd seen 15 to 20 families on a waiting list for each of the units. But in the past year, the number of families on the waiting list has grown to 30 to 40 per unit. That's quite something.
That's right. And that was according to, I guess, the Cape Cod Community Development Partnership. And really what they've said, too, is they're not quite sure what the reason is for the sudden uptick. The Jay Coburn, who is the CEO at the Cape Cod Community Development Partnership, said that, you know, some families are spending more than 30% of their income on housing, which is means that they would be cost burdened. They don't have enough money for unanticipated expenses like car repairs or medical emergencies, and that a lot of two-earner households make too much money to qualify for affordable housing, but not enough to really be able to be comfortable and afford the things that they need.
And it sounds like other agencies are reflecting some of this as well. The Housing Assistance Corporation kind of saying the same. They're seeing a lot of the same thing.
Yeah, they've said that they've seen a lot of landlords selling their homes, which forces renters out and diminishes the rental market. They've also seen an uptick in homeowners who need help financing repairs for their homes. And also they've seen more people moving from apartments into rooming houses.
We are going to speak now with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve.
Ed, Town of Wellfleet has signed on to a global covenant on climate change. Tell us, what does this mean for the town?
Well, this is a really interesting story out of Wellfleet, especially for anyone who is concerned about climate change and the lack of action on it at the federal level. The Wellfleet Selectmen last month signed on to this this initiative called the Global Covenant of Mayors for Climate and Energy. And this is a worldwide movement that involves now thousands of towns and cities around the world in committing to ambitious actions and goals related to reducing greenhouse gas emissions and reversing global warming and the terrible effects that are coming in the future, according to pretty much all the predictions of scientists. So this came about because of a member of the Wellfleet Energy Committee, Robert Shapiro, who was looking for a way to do a town-wide inventory of greenhouse gas emissions. And he found a tool for doing just that thing from a nonprofit organization called ICLEI, and learned about this covenant that way, went to the selectmen, told them about it, and they unanimously voted to endorse this covenant. What it does is it commits the town over the next 3 years to carrying out this inventory, which is basically an inventory of all the buildings, public and privately owned, and their emissions from burning fossil fuels, and then doing an assessment of climate hazards and vulnerabilities in the town, setting ambitious, measurable, time-bound targets to reduce or limit greenhouse gas emissions, creating plans to address climate change mitigation and low emission development, plans for just access to sustainable energy, meaning making it available to everyone, climate resilience, and producing regular progress reports. And the town has pledged to develop, formally adopt, and report on these measures within 3 years. If you go to the website for the Global Covenant of Mayors, you'll see that more than 9,000 cities and local governments have signed on to this covenant around the world, on six continents representing 127 countries and more than 770 million people. There's a total of 177 governments so far in North America. Mm. only 10 in Massachusetts, and so far only one on Cape Cod or the islands, and that's the town of Wellfleet. Mm-hmm. But the selectmen were quite excited to hear about this. They endorsed it enthusiastically, and one of the Wellfleet summer resident, Henrietta Davis, who is the former mayor of Cambridge. Cambridge is also signed on to this, as are Boston and Somerville. She commented when we contacted her, "This is great news. I'm so proud of this town." And she pointed out that local leadership in the United States can make all the difference in meeting the commitment of the Paris Climate Agreement, even without the federal government on board.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thank you for that this morning.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young, and joining us on the phone right now is George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, quite a large boat has been under construction for quite some time along Beach Road there in Vineyard Haven. Went into the water last weekend, but not without a little adventure. Tell us about this.
That's right. This is a scow that's been under construction for quite a while by Ted Box. He's a shipwright. And anybody going in and out of Vineyard Haven Harbor would see it next to the Packer Marine, right on the shoreline. And anybody who's crossed over the Lagoon Drawbridge from Oak Bluff into Vineyard Haven Harbor had definitely seen it. It had been there for quite a while. I'm told preschool kids had taken field trips there. And everybody was pretty excited when Ted said it was ready to go into the water. And so sure enough, on Saturday, with the help of a crew from Packer, he was able to get it into the water. It took a while. It didn't go all that smoothly. And also, once it got into the water, it started taking on water fairly quickly. And people were concerned that it might sink, but through some quick action, they were able to make sure that that didn't happen. Interestingly, I never knew this. You know, once the wood gets into the water, it swells up.
Mm-hmm.
But they also had a diver go underneath and release some sawdust, and apparently, the pressure sucks the sawdust up into the cracks and further seals the boat. Pretty interesting and old timey to coin a phrase there, I guess. But it was a very interesting day on Vineyard Haven Harbor that day. Both this happening and was the Vineyard Cup race happening that day as well. And even the Coast Guard came over and did a demonstration as part of Sail MV. So quite an exciting day on the water in Vineyard Haven Harbor.
And George, you also have a nice story about an island kid who made an unusual discovery while out sailing.
Yeah, this is 11-year-old Quinlan Slavin, and he was out with his cousin. His cousin's quite older than him. He's 56 years old. The two of them were out sailing, and they sailed by something in the water that looked pretty interesting. It was a yellow object bobbing in the water, and they couldn't quite figure it out. You know, this has been an area where the Army Corps of Engineers has been looking for unexploded ordnance, so they kind of steered clear of it.
Mm-hmm.
And went on their way. Later on, they came back, and Quinlan said, you know, it's yellow. It doesn't look very deteriorated. I'm going to go take a closer look. So he paddled out to it, and he saw a phone number on it. Sure enough, it was a phone number for Cornell University. He gave them he went back in, he got his cousin, they went out and brought it in, called the number, and sure enough, this is a research buoy that had been deployed by NOAA. And, you know, that data would have been lost had they not found it. They were able to bring it to the ferry where some scientists from Woods Hole picked it up. Everybody's really happy. Quinlan and his cousin get $250 for having found it and turned it in. And, you know, Quinlan got half of that. And he whispered to me that he was saving the money. I tried to get him to buy some ice cream with it. I said, you could buy quite a bit of ice cream. But he's a smart kid, and he's decided to put it in his bank account instead.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good weekend.
Yep. Kristen Young is with me from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, recreational marijuana sales are officially legal across the state, but it's been a very slow rollout. A number of Cape business people turned out this week to hear from the head of the state agency in charge of all things marijuana. What did they hear?
That's right. So the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce hosted a workshop Wednesday with Stephen Hoffman, who's the chairman of the state's Cannabis Control Commission. And really, the workshop was aimed at sort of allowing the businesses to understand regulations and the 10 types of licenses that the commission will eventually issue. Some of the questions that were asked included sort of when is this going to happen? When am I going to be able to walk into a store and purchase marijuana? And what Hoffman said was that sales could begin as early as the fall, likely after independent test laboratories are operational. But he also said that sales out on the Cape and Islands will probably lag behind the rest of the state. I guess out of the 73 completed license applications that the commission has received, none of them are on the Cape or the Islands. So until sort of those applications are applied for, then the licenses can't really be issued. There were some members in attendance. The owner of Dino Sports Bar in Mashpee said he has his sights set on applying for a social consumption license in order to sell marijuana pizza. There was also present at the meeting was the representatives from the Outer Cape Cannabis Connection, which is seeking a craft marijuana cooperative. There's a little history there. They've been embattled a little bit with the town over a host community agreement with the town of Truro in getting permission to operate there. So a lot still remains to be seen.
And it sounds like the Cape Cod Chamber is interested in seeing this move forward, but has a lot of questions too.
Yes, they do. And they're actually saying they may invite Hoffman back again for another workshop to kind of help answer some of the questions that are still sort of remain to be seen.
The fatal shooting of a Weymouth police officer over the weekend resonated particularly for Cape police officers. Your Cape Cod Times reporter Cindy McCormick had a story on this week.
That's right. So the Yarmouth Police Department, which as everybody knows, lost Sergeant Sean Gannon in April when he was shot in the line, killed in the line of duty, said that they've really been heartbroken by the news of the Weymouth officer being killed, and that they've also felt, you know, that connection that they have with the Weymouth Police Department, you know, has been made even more strong because of this. Yarmouth police officers traveled to Weymouth on Sunday to accompany the officer's body to the medical examiner's office, and more Yarmouth police intend to go to the funeral as well for Michael Chesna, who was the officer who was killed. You know, Chief Frank Fredrickson from the Yarmouth Police Department said that, you know, this is sort of shocking to see this happen again. Mm-hmm. So soon after the loss of Sean Gannon, and Deputy Chief Stephen Exaro said, you know, we need more help from the legislature, from people on Beacon Hill to gain more training for police officers and to really support our officers so that this doesn't continue to happen. Although Fredrickson did say right now the focus is really on the officer's family and on the woman, a bystander who was in her home at the time, who was also shot.
And it sounded like these police officers all from this portion of the state, they all trained together, which I didn't realize.
Yes, they had done some training together, both at a facility in Plymouth and another one elsewhere that's since been shut down. But they do a lot of, you know, there are limited training facilities available to police. And so a lot of the multiple departments utilize the same facility. So they have actually, Yarmouth Police have trained with the Weymouth Police Department in the past.
Let's speak right now with Andy Tomolonis from the South Coast Today and New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Andy.
Hi, Steve.
Andy, in New Bedford, part of the ground fishing fleet that hasn't been allowed to fish now for a long time, was given conditional permission to start fishing again. This is a big deal for the fleet and the fishing industry there. Tell us about this.
Yes, and it is a really big deal. It's tremendously complex, though, and I'll try to get into a little of the background and explain it. But it was about 8 months ago that NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, imposed a ban on ground fishing for the Sector 9. And that ban was lifted on Thursday. And it is a really big deal for the entire New Bedford fishing industry, not just for the fishermen, but for all the businesses that cater to fishermen. There's a support industry, marine fuel companies, mechanics, boat suppliers, net makers, ice, and all the many companies along New Bedford's waterfront that process the ground fish, flounder, haddock, cod, and other species. And to understand what happened back in November, and by extension, what happened yesterday, you almost need to have a course in fishing regulations. It's just very complex. There's sectors, there's quotas, leasing operations. There's a whole bunch of stuff. But I can give you a very quick background, and I hope I can keep it brief. About 2.5 years ago, federal authorities raided Carlos Rafael, the cod father. They charged him with conspiracy, falsifying records, and other charges, smuggling cash out of Logan Airport. And he was running this elaborate scam that allowed him to bypass fishing regulations and rules, selling his catch on the black market to a seafood buyer in New York. So he owned boats and fishing permits and the wholesale business Carlos Seafood. So he was able to misrepresent the catch, lie about what he caught, the types of fish that he caught. He'd catch something, and I'm not sure the species, but he'd catch something like cod, which had a small quota. He would report the catch as haddock or another species that had a much higher quota. And that allowed him to catch fish and sell really anything he wanted to. Federal agents investigated him. They raided him. They had agents posing as Russian underworld figures who wanted to buy the business from Carlos, and they got him on tape. So the whole thing was explained on tape by Carlos, and they had him. And he pleaded guilty, and now he's serving 46 months, almost 4 years in prison. So his years of working this elaborate scheme had some far-reaching effects. I mean, not only might it have depleted some of the stocks of the select species that he caught, but it threw a monkey wrench into the entire system of counting groundfish and reporting them. So NOAA had a significant problem here. And in November, NOAA banned Carlos's group of fishing boats. It's known as Sector 9. Now, a sector is not a region or an area of fishing. Sometimes people get that image. A sector is a group of fishermen, and this group couldn't lease any quota. It's a sector of what they can do is they can fish or they can lease their quota that they receive from NOAA.
Mm-hmm.
And the sector is a group of fishermen. They have their permits. They're granted the quotas to catch a limited amount of species, and they can lease their quotas to other fishermen. So when the quota is filled, they can't have to stop fishing. So sometimes these fishermen trade it around. So if they're out of cod, they can get cod quota that allows them to go catch other fish. Because you can't whatever or you catch, you have to keep and you have to report.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very complex thing. And so because Carlos misrepresented his catch, NOAA wanted to find out as close as possible what was really caught. And then they could make adjustment, assist penalties and all that before letting the group go back to fishing. And there was an 8-month delay doing that. And it naturally hurt New Bedford's fishing industry. Some 80 fishermen were idled. There were estimates that it was up to 240 jobs that were lost due to the ban. And the fishermen were all in limbo at this time, even fishermen who were outside of Carlos's group, because Carlos had a lot of quota. Mm-hmm. And if they couldn't lease quota from Carlos, they couldn't go out fishing. So it hurt a lot more people than just Carlos. And that was something that the mayor was talking about and a lot of fishing advocates were talking about, too.
And then now this looks like these fishermen are going to be able to turn towards fishing soon.
Yes, exactly. So what NOAA did exactly is not just let everybody go back to fishing. So they're now letting Sector 9, which was the sector made up of boats and permits owned by Carlos, it can lease its quota, and that will allow other fishermen to use the quota and actually go out fishing.
Mm-hmm.
But Sector 9 boats can't just go out and fish. And so the sector also has to pay back quota of a certain species of fish, and that's it's like 72,000 pounds of witch flounder.
Mm.
Witch flounder is this kind of a flatfish like a flounder, sole, or a halibut. And also NOAA is allowing Sector 7, another sector, that will be allowed to lease its quota. And that's the group that has boat owners who left Sector 9. These fishermen in Sector 7, they can't fish either, but they will be able to go out and fish eventually after all the boats that are owned by Carlos have been sold. So it's very complex. There's a lot happening. But one thing that NOAA did was it made its ban immediate. It waived a period of comment. So, you know, the action takes effect immediately. But there still has to be a little delay as quota gets leased and the fishermen who go out gear up and everything. So
it is complicated.
It is a really big deal. And if you want to find out more about this, in including all the, you know, we have the documents from NOAA, you can go to our special website on fishing. It's southcoasttoday.com/fisheries. And you can read over and over as many stories as you want to read about fishing.
Hey, Andy Tomolonis of southcoasttoday.com. Andy, thank you for laying that out for us.
All right, thank you.
Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times is with me. Kristen, the Barnstable County Sheriff's Office has long had a program that supplied tents for community service organizations, and that program now is coming to an end.
Yes, it's been a 14-year run for the program, which has become very popular with nonprofits and with government organizations who rely on the tents for events. But what the sheriff's office has said is that really the program has become a victim of its own success, that their work crew programs, which also assist with other things, labor, landscaping, that type of thing, are really being kept too busy by these tent requests to keep up with other projects. Some of the other things they did recently of note, they helped to reconstruct the Gray's Beach Boardwalk in Yarmouth. They helped with the Sandwich Boardwalk after both those boardwalks were sustained some damage from storms earlier this year. And so Sheriff Jim Cummings has said, you know, we can't be in two places at once. And so that, coupled with the need to replace some of the aging tents, which would incur costs, some town regulations and security concerns, has led the sheriff's office to say, we're going to table the tent program and bring that to a close.
It sounds like some groups are going to miss it, that they really depended on this.
Some of the nonprofits have said that they really depend on this every year. The tents have been used at the annual Troops in the Spotlight event, which is held every Memorial Day weekend in Hyannis. And Michelle Da Silva, who works with Cape Cod Cares for the Troops, which organizes the event, said, you know, that's just going to be another expense that they'll have to incur. Some various tent groups around the Cape have also sort of stepped up and said, well, you know, we will offer to help out with nonprofits who are seeking our services. American Tent in Marston's Mills said that they work with, they usually give back 10% to the organizations if it's a nonprofit who's seeking to have tent services provided.
I want to ask you about a story that you covered about the Dennis Yarmouth School District changing the way it typically seeks approval for plans to build a new middle school.
That's right. The Dennis Yarmouth School Committee said they voted on Monday not to have the process of construction costs being approved for the new middle school go through town meeting. Instead, it will go directly to a district-wide vote, which is the same process that was followed by the Cape Cod Regional Technical High School recently when they were seeking approval for funds to build that school, which is currently still in the works. But what the school committee members said is that by allowing it to go to a district-wide vote, more voters will actually get to weigh in. Over 2,000 people in each of the respective towns voted in the Cape Tech decision when it went directly to a ballot, but only about 300 to 400 people in each town typically show up to town meeting. So by sending the vote directly to a ballot, they're saying it'll encourage more voter participation, and it will also possibly help the project to get approved. One of the things that was brought up at the meeting was the fact that town meetings are often difficult for working families who may have school-aged children to attend. They require, you know, several hours at a time when people may otherwise have childcare obligations or sports obligations if they have young kids. And so people with children in school who may vote in favor of the project may not be able to attend town meetings, whereas popping into a voting booth may take 5-10 minutes of your day.
And that any delays in these projects really run up the cost with the projects.
That's right. The project, which is estimated to cost about $109 million, is eligible for about $61.2 million in reimbursement from the Massachusetts School Building Authority. But the problem there is that the MSBA also accounts for about $500,000 a month in inflation costs. And because their board only meets every 2 months, that means that every time the Dennis Yarmuth School Board misses an opportunity to submit a required application, it adds $1 million to the cost of the project. So they say there's a lot of interest toward taxpayers to getting this done as quickly as possible.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, your first time here. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Steve. It was great to be here.
And thank you to our other contributors. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.